Before I start the sutta for this evening, I've been asked to say something about walking meditation as well, for those who are beginners here. So the idea with walking meditation is that you can interchange a bit from sitting and walking. Sometimes you get a bit stiff, or you had enough of sitting, or you feel a bit restless or whatever. And if that is the case, sometimes it's good to just to change your posture. And one of the classical postures of meditation is the walking meditation. And to do walking meditation, nice thing to do is to have like a path, maybe 20 to 30 steps long. And then you use that path to walk back and forth on that path. And sometimes it's good maybe to put your hands together like this, either in the back or the front, so that you're kind of reminding yourself that you are doing walking meditation. If you just have your hands hanging on the sides, it's like walking anywhere, so you don't really feel like you're meditating, right? So put them in front or behind your back, depending on what is comfortable. And then you walk that stretch back and forth, 20 to 30 paces. And what you do there depends on what you need to do. So if you feel a bit restless, or you feel a bit, you had enough of sitting, you just want to relax a little bit, which is very common, then just walk back and forth, and just enjoy the peace, just enjoy this, you know, enjoy being here on retreat. And don't gaze too much around, because if you gaze too much around, you sort of become very distracted. But just enjoy the peace of the place a little bit by walking back and forth, allowing your mind to wander. That's perfectly okay here. This is one way of doing walking meditation. If you find that your meditation is going really well and you are following the breath or whatever, everything is very peaceful, then you can focus on the feeling, the sensation in your feet as you walk back and forth. So you feel all the sensations in your feet as you touch the ground, then the feel the pressure in the sole of the foot, and then how the changing in the feeling in the foot as it moves, and then the next foot as it moves forward and goes down. You just follow the sensation in the feet as you walk back and forth. You come to the end, 30 steps, you turn around, and you feel the sensation as you walk back again. That is a way of kind of focusing, keeping your focus in your meditation practice. Those are the two main things you can do in walking meditation. You can basically do anything you like in walking meditation, just like whatever you want to do while you're sitting. Just the same things you can do while walking as well. That's a very brief introduction to walking meditation, but hopefully it will be enough to get you started at least, and then we can talk more about it later on, perhaps, if people require. Okay, so now we come to the suttas. And this first sutta that I'm going to talk about today is called the Soil Remover. And this sutta is really very similar to what we call the gradual training in the suttas. The gradual training is a particular type of sutta that you see throughout the discourses of the Buddha. And the gradual training is basically shows you the training of a person from the very beginning of the Buddhist path to the very end, right? The whole training from the beginning to the end. It's very interesting, right? It's very exciting. Here you are. This is where many of us start off at the beginning. Then it shows you what you have to do to become fully awakened. Not about you, but for me that's very exciting, very interesting when I see that. And this particular thing called the gradual training, it is a type of sutta that you see many, many, many times in the discourses of the Buddha. In the Digha Nikaya, long discourses of the Buddha, you see at least 10 times out of 34 suttas, 10 times you have the gradual training here. In the Majjhima Nikaya, I haven't counted, but about 20 times perhaps in the Majjhima Nikaya, these are the middle-length sayings, again, you have it 20 times. So all the types of suttas that you find anywhere, this is the one that occurs the most often. And because of that, basically means that it's very important. And you can see why, because it outlines the training from the beginning to the very end. So this is what I want to talk about and focus on this retreat, is this gradual training here. Because I think it's very important, and I think it's very, every time I read it, I get really into this sutta. I find it very kind of exciting. And it shows you, because it is a training stage by stage, you can sort of figure out, where am I on this training? What is my kind of stage in this training? And then you know where you have to focus your energy and your attention, right? Because you can see where you're lacking here. And then you can continue moving on towards the goal of this practice. So this is a very interesting and the nice thing, of course, about the suttas, that they are like an interlocking whole. They are like a jigsaw puzzle where every piece fits together. And because the gradual training is like a framework into which so much else can be put, once you understand the gradual training, you can take other aspects of the teaching and place them into the gradual training and kind of expand it indefinitely. You can look at one piece and you can see that, wow, this piece relates to another sutta. And in that sutta, you can read that one, and then you can, that gives you more information about that particular place in the gradual training, right? So it's something that can be expanded. It's like a skeleton, or like a skeleton on which you can hang all these things, right? And then it all comes together very beautifully here. So that is why what I want to focus on, and in this gradual training here, what you find is that the most important part of the gradual training is always the beginning here. If you get the beginning right, if the beginning is there, then the rest tends to flow by itself. So the beginning is always the most important thing. So I'm going to focus a lot on the beginning here, not because I think that you are all beginners necessarily, but just because the beginning is important for everyone. Whether you are a beginner or whether you are advanced, the beginning is always powerful and has a lot to do with how the rest of the path actually functions. So this sutta here, the soil remover then, this is not actually the gradual training as such, but it is a sutta with a similar kind of structure here. So it gives you, it's a way of getting us into the gradual training here. So I will just start reading, and then I will comment as we go along here. If you have any questions about lack of clarity in what I'm saying, you can probably ask those questions straight away. Otherwise, we'll do question tomorrow evening here. So if you have any questions about the sutta in general or relating things, you can write them down and we can do those tomorrow evening here. Okay, so this is the soil remover from the Anguttara Nikaya. Anguttara means like the numerical. Nikaya is like collection, the numerical collection here. The three is sutta number 101 there. And it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, there are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Now the soil remover or his apprentice first pours the gold into a, how do you pronounce this word? Trough, yeah. And washes, rinses, and cleans it. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilements in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot and fans it, melts it and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy, luminous, but still brittle and not fit for work. But as the goldsmith or his apprentice continues to fan, melt and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled. The dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy and luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So that is the simile of the goldsmith and the simile of the soil remover. The next, after this, the next thing here is to say that this simile applies to purifying the mind. So the purification of the mind comes after this, and this is a simile that illustrates the purification of the mind, right? So one of the interesting things here, of course, straight away, is that he uses a simile, he uses gold. So what that means, of course, is that here the mind is likened to gold, right? And that is already quite fascinating, quite interesting, because gold is something very precious. So the mind is something very precious, right? This is the meaning of this. The mind is something very beautiful and precious in just the same way as gold. And the reason why it is that, of course, just like gold, when the gold comes out of the ground, it isn't very precious to begin with. It's just potentially there within all the soil, within all the gravel, within all the dirt. But it can be purified. You can get the preciousness out of it if you perform the right procedure for getting precious gold out of the ore which comes out of the ground. And exactly the same way, the mind is there. You may not feel that your mind is very precious as it is. Sometimes there are all kinds of defilements going on, and it's clouded and confused or whatever. And of course, but the point is that potentially the gold of the mind is there under the surface, right? This is the point of the simile. And of course, the mind is not just like gold. It's much, much more precious than gold. Why? Because it is conducive to enormous amounts of happiness if you train and develop and cultivate the mind in the right way. This is the power of the mind. Just like the gold, you have to remove the dross stage by stage, and then you refine the mind, and you get the precious beauty of the mind out of that mind which was defiled beforehand. And the happiness that comes from a developed mind, there's nothing like that type of happiness available anywhere, and that is why it is so powerful. Gold obviously just pales by comparison in this particular simile. So that is the first aspect here. The mind is like gold, something very precious and important. The second aspect is that there is a procedure by which you get the gold purified from the dross and from all the gravel and all the defilements that exist in the gold. And you have to follow that procedure, right? You cannot start off by taking out the black dust. You have to start off by taking out all the coarse stuff. The soil, the grit and the gravel, that has to come out first. And then you can move on to removing the more refined defilements of the gold. Then you can do the most refined ones. And then you can smelt the gold and you can pour it back and forth and do all this kind of goldsmith things, which then purifies it completely. The mind is exactly the same thing. There is a certain procedure, a certain sequence to actually refining the mind. You cannot start by, kind of refining the most refined obstacles that we have. You have to start off with the really coarse ones. So you have to know yourself. This is one of the most important things on the Buddhist path and in meditation practice, is to know yourself. Where am I at? What is my mind like? What are my problems? What do I have to do? If you try to watch the breath when the mind isn't ready, you're just going to get frustrated. It's not going to work. So you have to wait. You have to know when the mind is right for watching the breath. You have to know whether what you need to do is to maybe deal with coarse defilements, or have you got the medium defilements of the mind. And once you start to sort these things out, have some understanding of yourself, then you can apply the right method for yourself, for your particular path, for where you are at on the path. And this is so important. Otherwise, you will just waste so much time trying to do things that you cannot actually do because you aren't ready for doing those particular things. So that is the importance here of this particular simile, both in regards to the goal and the sequential process in refining it. Then it says further down here, it says that eventually you come to the point where the gold is malleable, wieldy, luminous, and pliant, and properly fit for work. So here again, the simile is with the mind, right? The mind is also pliant. And these words here are very important words that show you what the mind is supposed to be like. The mind that is purified, the mind that is clean, is malleable. You can direct it wherever you want. It just does what you want to do, right? And that is why it is very powerful for insight. So it is malleable, it is wieldy, it is easy to move around, just like the gold. Luminous, it says here. I think the word luminous here is pabassara. Pabassara is this word which is often spoken about in many, you find this in academic journals all over the place, talking about the pabassara citta, and not only there, but many people talk about this word as if it means something special. But here you see what it means. What it means, pabassara means something free of defilements. So when the mind is free of the defilements, that's when you have the pabassara mind. Citta is mind. The luminous mind, right? The mind becomes luminous. Just like gold becomes luminous and shiny when it's refined, the mind becomes luminous and shiny when it's free of defilements, clear and powerful, and then fit for work, as it says here. So it's good, often important, to see these words in context to understand what they actually refer to. So that is the simile there. And then we can move on to how you actually use this simile and apply it to the purification of the mind itself. It says bhikkhus here. Bhikkhu is a monk, right? In case you don't know, it's a Buddhist monk. But of course, it doesn't mean that this is only applicable to Buddhist monks. It's applicable to anybody. It's just that the Buddha would normally speak to the monks. So because he normally spoke to the monks, that's why bhikkhus, that's what is stated here. So now we come to the development of the mind, the purification of the mind. So too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, there are in him gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him subtle defilements, thoughts about his relations, thoughts about his country, thoughts about his reputation. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. That concentration is not peaceful and sublime, not gained by full tranquilization, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forceful suppression of the defilements. So I will stop there for now. Have a look at that first part. There's a lot of information already in there. So the first thing here is to notice that this is a bhikkhu who is devoted to the higher mind, right? The higher mind is, in Pali, is called the adi-citta. Citta, again, meaning mind. And the higher mind in Pali means samadhi. It means the stillness, right? The result of deep meditation that you get when you get very, very deep in meditation. In particular, it means the jhana states. These very very important states that are talked about in the Buddha Suttas. So if you are aiming for jhana, if you are aiming for samadhi, which then also would include insight, then, of course, this is what you should be doing here. You need to purify the mind. Now, this is already very important, because very often, as I was talking about before, we often think that meditation is all about meditation subjects, right? It's about using this subject, the breath, the metta, and all these kind of things. We think that this is what actually drives the meditation process. But actually, what the Buddha is saying here is that meditation subject, of course, that's an important part of it as well. But for meditation to work, for you to be able to get to this adi-citta, the samadhi state, what you really have to do is purify the mind. When you purify the mind, that is when the deep samadhi becomes possible. So, for that, you know that if somebody gains a deep state of samadhi, it means that they have already are a very pure person. at least every period at that time when they attain that samadhi state. And if you want to move towards more samadhi, but you are not having all that much success, well, again, it is means that your mind isn't pure enough. That's essentially what it means. So you have to find the mind, the means of then actually purifying the mind to the point where samadhi happens by itself. And there's all kinds of ways of purifying the mind, and this is what one of the things I will talk about later on, but this is like the outline of that. So the first thing then, the first thing that we need to purify, these are the most coarse or gross defilements, these are bodily, verbal and mental misconduct. And this is very similar to what you find so many places in the suttas. You find something called the 10 ways of unwholesome action that you find in the suttas again and again. And bodily action is divided into 3, verbal action into 4, and mental action into 3. And this is essentially what we are talking about here. So bodily misconduct is, right, it's the kind of standard, basically the part of the precepts, right? It's not killing living beings, not stealing, and not sexual misconduct is essentially what it means. That's the bodily one. We come back to this later on. I'm not going to go into detail of these things now. You have the verbal one. It's just, you know, the standard verbal misconduct of lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. And then the mental misconduct here, the main aspects of this is a kind of strong ill will or strong desires, a kind of ill will where you want to kill somebody, right? Oh, this person, really, I've had too much of this person. And now I just would like to obliterate either maybe a person or this animal, this, you know, I'd like to kill this animal or whatever. That desire to kill or to harm somebody, you know, that is like a very powerful kind of ill will that is talked about here. And also the other aspect here is the covetousness, the desire, you know, for the property of other people, which can be a basis for stealing, right? If you want something very strongly that belongs to somebody else, can be a foundation for stealing. So this is the mental misconduct, which is so strong that it becomes a foundation for actually breaking the precepts and doing wrong things based on that. That is what this is meant here. That's a very strong kind of mental misconduct. It is surprising. I always find it surprising how almost everybody sometimes has, you know, very strong negative feelings perhaps towards somebody. Maybe only it lasts a short time. But occasionally most people have these very strong feelings. I remember reading some research from a university in the United States. They had done a questionnaire among certain college students and asked them about any violent thoughts they had had in the last week or so, something like that. And specifically about any thoughts connected with killing other people. And I think 90 or 95% of the students said they had some kind of fantasy about killing somebody else. So it's very common. That's basically what it says. It's quite common that occasionally you have these kind of feelings, which means you don't have to feel too bad about it when you have them. It's just the way it is. So instead of feeling bad about it, let's see what we can do about it to overcome these things. That's what this is about. So this is the first thing, is to actually overcome these things. So this is overcome by keeping precepts. And it's also overcome, and this you see here, it uses this very strong language. It says that an earnest, capable person, he abandons these things, dispels them, terminates them, and obliterates them. And this particular phrase, abandoning, dispelling, terminating, and obliterating, it's very important to understand what that means. Because it sounds like, I remember when I read that first, I thought, what on earth does this mean? Does it mean I, you know, should use a lot of willpower and push these things aside and kind of pretend I don't see them inside myself because it is too embarrassing to have these kind of thoughts or whatever? Is that what I should be doing? What does this mean? It sounds almost violent in itself, right? To obliterate something, terminate it. And the answer is, and I think I've spoken about this on a number of occasions, but the answer is simply that what it means is that you use reflection, wise ways of looking at things. What in Pali is called yoniso manasikara, what is called yoniso patisanka, these are Pali words, which means wise reflection. And it is wise reflection that is the main way of getting rid of these defilements. You think in a way so that these things are just dispelled by themselves. And once you understand that actually wise reflection is the clue here, and this is something you see throughout the suttas, where the Buddha teaches you ways of reflecting in such a way that these things are dispelled, once you understand that actually it's wisdom that does this, then you can understand why it says dispels, obliterates, and terminates. Because it is only wisdom that has the ability to abandon these things so completely that it looks like they are obliterated from the mind. Only wisdom can do that. If you try to use willpower, you cannot obliterate things using willpower. It can only be used by wise and skillful reflection. This is a very important point, and it's something I will return to during this retreat later on. And basically, how do we use this? What are some skillful ways of using the mind so we can obliterate the wrong way of thinking and behaving here? Okay, so that is the first aspect there, the gross kind of defilements, and then when those have been eliminated, there remain in him the middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. So these are like a level down. Once you have gotten rid of the worst ones, you still have, thoughts very commonly, of desires or, lesser thoughts of ill will, irritations, whatever. All of these things that we have quite regularly on a regular basis. These are the things that are meant here. Thoughts of harming here. Harming can also, the word here can also just mean that you are callous or indifferent to the suffering of other beings. The word here is the opposite of karuna. Karuna is compassion. So this hinsa or vihinsa is the opposite of karuna. So what is the opposite of compassion? Well, it's like being cold-hearted, right? Callous, hard-hearted, indifferent, not caring about others, etc. That is what, inconsiderate perhaps even, is what is meant by this particular thing. So these are the things that you abandon. And again, the same thing is again stated here. The capable person, he abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates these mental states. And again, the only way you can actually obliterate these things is through reflecting in a wise way. If you reflect in a wise way, that is how these things disappear. Maybe I should say a little bit about how you reflect on something in a wise way, because at least some general principles. The first principle is to remember that if you are going, when these things arise, it's usually too late to, at that point, reflect for the first time about why these things are bad. Usually with reflection, you have to build up certain ideas in your mind. You have to build up certain perceptions, certain ways of looking at things. You have to build it up over time. So it becomes a very strong thought inside of you. In other words, you need clarity about why something is harmful, why it's bad, why you want to avoid it. So once you have developed it up over time, you know that ill will is, you don't want to go there. Once that is very clear, why it doesn't work, why it's painful, why it leads to problems, then you can use that clarity when it starts to arise, and then you can obliterate it. So as a general principle, you have to actually reflect on these things quite a lot to be able to use it in your practice. And then when you sit down to meditate, you try to become peaceful and some kind of bad thoughts arises, and all you have to do is you have to bring up that perception, that thought that you built up in the past, whatever it is, and by bringing up that perception, it goes. Ideally, it goes, I should say. It doesn't always work, but ideally then it goes, right? And then you are on the right track, yeah? So this is how it works. You build up the capacity for doing these things, and then you use that capacity in your meditation, outside of your meditation, in daily life, whenever it is required. These tools that are talked about here are tools that are applicable across the board. They don't just refer to meditation practice or outside meditation. They refer to everything. The Buddhist path is an integral path. It's a path which relates to your whole life. It doesn't just relate to, coming on retreat or whatever. Or ideally, I should say, it relates to the whole life. Okay, so then if you are able to abandon that, there remain in him subtle defilements, thoughts about his relations, thoughts about his country, thoughts about his reputation. These are things, you can probably guess that these are things that have to do with your sense of self, right? Who you are, who are your relations. You know, we have very strong connection to family members, right? We define ourselves in relation to who our family members are. I'm the son, or I'm the daughter, or I'm the father or mother, or whatever it is. We have a kind of position in relation to our relations. So your sense of self is very much tied up in that way. About your country, you think about where you're from, what language you speak. We tend to, again, identify with that. Or about your reputation, right? We all want to have a good reputation, etc. But all of these things are about the sense of self. And all of these things are very limiting. You know, if you think of yourself as being from a particular country, who cares what country you're from? That's what I tend to think. It doesn't matter whether you are from... I was born in Norway, but I've been living so long now in Australia, I'm not really sure what I am anymore. But how nice that is not to really have a home country here. You just are a person, and that's good enough, right? At least if you are a good person, that's good enough. And also this idea of being any particular relationship to your family, what does it really matter? They're all people, right? People are just people, whether they are your family members or not. And as you start to dissolve that sense of self, of who you are, that is also one of the things that limit you to get into samadhi. Because a sense of self has to be built up, it has to be kept in check. It is something that you think about all the time, it tends to come back to you. Because who you are, it's obviously important, so you think about it. When the mind becomes peaceful, then perhaps you start thinking about these things, because it is a very ingrained part of how you see yourself. So once these things start to decline, once you identify less with all these kind of things, actually it is very helpful for samadhi, because you don't care about those things anymore. It doesn't matter. Those things are irrelevant. You are just a person, and that's good enough. So you abandon those things because you see the limitation in those things, right? The problem in those things. And when this has been done, then it says here, there remain only thoughts connected with the Dhamma, which I think that a better translation for that is that these are thoughts not connected with the Dhamma, but thoughts that accord with the Dhamma. In other words, thinking can be divided into two different types: thought that goes against the Dhamma, and these are thoughts of ill will, desire, and then you have the thoughts that are in accordance with the Dhamma: metta, compassion, renunciation, etc. But even these thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, they are still thinking. They are still a movement of the mind. So whatever is samadhi that you can have based on that kind of thought is still not going to be very profound. So you have to go beyond all thinking. And this is the message of one of the other suttas. If you want to read that sutta yourself, this is the Majjhima Nikaya number 19, the two kinds of thought. But the message is very clearly, you move away from the coarse thinking, you abandon that. But then even the good thinking, the Dhamma thinking, so to speak, has to be abandoned to be able to reach a really profound state of samadhi. So this is what that is talking about. And then that is when your mind starts to become incredibly still and peaceful when that happens. So there you are. That gives you the outline how to practice the path. So now you have to figure out for yourself roughly where you are, where your position is here, and what you need to do. And many of us, we have to do a little bit, perhaps on the number of levels, but of course the first level here is the most important one. That is what really is important in this particular case. So you have to find out for yourself roughly what where you are at, and then you can and make maximum amount of progress in your meditation practice. And then it says that when you have those thoughts connected with the Dhamma, that samadhi, that concentration, it says here, is not still peaceful and sublime, etc. But because, the Buddha says, there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and concentrated, and stilled, if you like. That concentration, that stillness, is peaceful and sublime, gained by full tranquilization and attained to unification. It is not reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Then, there being a suitable basis, he is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. So, here, what we're seeing here, this is very deep now. I'll go through it anyway because it's interesting, I think. So, first thing it says here, there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steady, etc. Now, this internally steady, composed, unified, this is a word for deep samadhi, for the jhanas in particular. And it's interesting here how it says, there comes a time, right? It doesn't say when that time is. It doesn't say when you have done this, this will happen. It just says, there comes a time. Just like the gold before is ready. So what does that mean? What does it say, there comes a time? And the reason is because it's very hard to gauge the progress on the path sometimes. All you can know is that you're progressing. All you can know is that the defilements are going down. All you can know is that mindfulness is becoming more powerful, that you feel more kind inside of you, that you are increasing in the good states and declining in bad ones. You can see that, but you just don't know when this is going to come together. But if you keep doing it, there will come a time. That is the message here. You don't know when it will be, but that time will definitely come. So that is the promise, in a sense, of this sutta, that if you keep doing the right thing, then it will happen eventually. And then, that concentration, that stillness, Ajahn Brahm always calls it stillness rather than concentration, and I think he has a good point with that. That is peaceful and sublime. Panitang, santa and panita, gained by full tranquilization. It's completely tranquil, completely peaceful. No more movement, right? Attained to unification. No more duality in this type of consciousness, this type of samadhi. Yeah. And it is not reined in and forcefully suppressing the defilements. What this means is that the will is no longer actively controlling the samadhi. The will has stopped, or the will has become frozen in that particular state. It's no longer doing anything. So imagine this state. It's very, very powerful, isn't it? Something very unusual. There's no active will anymore. Mind is completely solid, no movement whatsoever, full tranquility. It's called sublime and all these other things. This is something very profound and very amazing, very different from what we're used to in ordinary life. And it is for that reason, because it is so amazing and so powerful and so blissful, and all these adjectives that are used throughout the suttas to explain these things, that is why he then is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. What this means is that whatever insight you want, if you incline your mind to full awakening according to the Buddha's teachings, if you incline it to recollection of past lives and all these other kind of things, at that point you are ready for that. And this shows you again, as you find so many places elsewhere in the sutta, that once you have gotten to that deep samadhi, then it's all open for you. You have essentially reached the end of the Buddhist path, and now all you have to do is just to allow the insights and the understandings to come by themselves. You are ready for that. The path ends with deep samadhi, and then all you have to do is incline your mind, and everything else happens from that. That's what this is saying, which of course is exactly what the Noble Eightfold Path says. It ends with Samma Samadhi. So those are some very profound things towards the end there. It's always nice to hear about the profound things because it's inspiring, I find. It's very nice to hear about these things. But for most of us, it's important to understand this idea of gradual purification. What do we need to purify to make progress? Never worry about what other people are doing. Never desire the results. this is one of the consequences of this idea of there comes a time, means that there's no point in desiring these things because you don't know when it's going to happen. If you don't know when it's going to happen, why desire it? All you have to do is be patient and wait. And when the time is right, it will happen by itself. So focus on what you need to do, which is self-purification, and then you will be on the right track and you will be doing fine. Okay, so it's already past 9:30 here. So that is just a little introduction to you, for you. And we will continue in this vein throughout this retreat and see what happens as we go along. Are there any questions before we call it an evening? Is everybody happy? Yeah. Everybody okay? Okay, good. That's good news. Just keep on enjoying yourself. And I'm not sure when I will be seeing you tomorrow morning. I'm certainly going to be here for the talk at 8:30. I might come before that as well. We'll see what happens. So have a nice evening and just enjoy yourself and see you tomorrow.